Hello, everybody. I'm Joel Barbahan. I'm an alcoholic. I'm in things already, knocking stuff around up here, fumbling about. Thank you for asking me. Thank you, Sam. I live in Towson, Maryland. It's a little bit north of Baltimore, and I'm a member of the Howard County Speakers Group, which is a relatively new group with a very similar format to the one you have here. We meet on Tuesday nights at 8:30. I came directly from Danville, Pennsylvania, which is about an hour and a half north of Harrisburg. And then about 10 minutes before I pulled up here, I realized the clothes I packed, I have checkered pants and a striped shirt. So luckily I'm hidden behind this podium, so I apologize for my fashion faux pas. This is life. I had a wonderful drive today, all the way just down, I guess, the spine of the mountains, down 81. Got to talk to a couple of sponsees and my cousin and my parents and my fiance. Life is wonderful. I understand you guys have a really nice, clean format. Give me lots of time to talk. I didn't plan anything at all to talk other than the joke about the fashion thing, which I came up with a minute ago. My sponsor a number of years ago suggested to me that I not plan what I'm going to say when I stand up in front of people. I guess largely in an effort to keep me from getting in the way as much as possible of God at some point kicking in and trying to speak or reflect or do whatever he does. But what I do generally try to do is basically, I know people break it down in tons of different ways, but the way I look at it, I try to break things down as simply as possible. You know, my job here is to talk about my own experience with alcoholism, what it's like, in my opinion, in my experience, to have alcoholism, suffer from it, have a pretty uncomfortable experience in life with that, and then also my own experience with recovery from alcoholism. I could talk for 3 hours about what I think other people are doing or shouldn't be doing, or what I've done that didn't work. I've all this wonderful experience of things that I did that didn't work, both drunk and sober. But I will try my best to get through the drinking and get into recovery and actually share with you guys some of the really fantastic things that you as a fellowship have shown me and the directions that I've been pointed and some of the really, really amazing experiences that I've been able to have. You know, really just the experience of being a normal, relatively healthy, generally functioning person that can wake up in the morning and be pretty happy to be me, and then do my stuff all day long, and then lay down at night without regrets and without feeling like I'm missing something, you know, missing something major in my life, or that I've done something wrong, or that there's something dirty about me, and lay down and 10 minutes later be snoring. You know, that to me is a fantastic gift that Alcoholics Anonymous and the experiences I've had here, and you know, finding a way to have a simple path towards a relationship with the power greater than me, greater than human. So to go back to that, you know, the reason that basic sort of daily experience is such a big deal for me is because for a huge part of my life, that wasn't my experience at all. You know, I believe I have this thing that I, you know, called alcoholism. And, you know, for me, one of the major parts of that is this thing our literature talks about as a spiritual malady, which are words that for a long time for me were scary, or I thought someone was about to tell me how to live my life and a bunch of stuff that I didn't want to hear. But I think really at the core of it, it's just a matter of, you know, saying that my spirit is sick, you know, that there's something, you know, this experience that I had for a long time where there's something in me, something deep down in me, this overriding kind of feeling that something is off, you know, that there's something different for me. You know, it's a thing that alcoholics try so hard to talk about. You know, I think it's one of the most difficult things to try to stand up in front of people and actually, you know, throw words at you to explain it, because nothing really suffices to explain it. I think what we do is throw words at it, and if you have it, you kind of understand and, like, know what that experience is like. And if you don't, then you just kind of do one of these sort of, you know, sideways and don't really understand it. But, you know, for me, it was just this thing of, as I see it today, a lack of awareness in my heart, you know, as people say, not in my head, not intellectually, but a lack of this faith and this confidence and this feeling in my heart that I'm okay, that I'm not better than anyone else around me, and I'm not worse than anyone else around me. I was just created as me, and that's fine. That I don't have to be the fastest, strongest, smartest, funniest, bestest at anything. That I can just feel okay, to just sit in a lazy boy for half an hour at 8:30, you know, or well, 11:30 or whatever, I guess these days, what life is really like, and just be fine with me, you know, not think there's got to be something else missing. I wish I'd said this. I wish I had that. If my shoes were different, if my nose was less pointy, if my butt was flatter, if this was different, if I had more money, if you knew me, if I just had a case of Mad Dog under the bed upstairs, if I had this, if I had that, you know, just constantly, you know what I mean? Because my experience for so long was to kind of come to the table with that feeling, you know, and on a daily basis, it would show itself in all these different ways. And then what would happen is, you know, I would show up and I'd feel lonely, you know, and I'd think, well, what I need is a relationship. I need great friends to show me something and they'll make me feel different. You know, I'd feel like I'm unlovable. So what I need is a romantic relationship. And if that person or the right person, this mythical, perfect person was there and showed me that kind of love, then I would feel that kind of love and I wouldn't feel like this, you know. And I'd apply that fear-based approach to all of life. You know, I'm afraid of being poor, so let's see how big of a mountain of money I can scrape together. And then if I have that, I'll feel different. You know, that's this huge theme running throughout my life before I drank, during the time I drank, and after the time I drank for a few years of, frankly, treating this spiritual malady with worldly things and getting mixed results at best. A lot of mess, a lot of confusion, a lot of frustration, a lot of gears and wheels spinning without a lot of movement. You know, strings of relationships with people kind of wondering what just happened. And, you know, me left with, you know, just sort of constantly degrading myself, going to ever deeper, lower, more extreme lengths to chase these things, you know. And for me, none of those things, and you know, my experience of all those things was nowhere more extreme than with the drink. You know, I did drink, loved the drink, found the drink when I was relatively young, you know, from the very beginning, I absolutely loved it. For what it's worth, I was about 11 when I started drinking. Age has nothing to do with this thing. You know, when I got sober, I was of a different age than most of the people around me, and those that were most helpful to me ignored that fact and simply looked at the fact that I was an alcoholic suffering the way that they were suffering, and you know, didn't throw out there the difference that I could use to sort of separate myself from you and to say yeah, but, and those sorts of things. But nonetheless, I had some absolutely fantastic experiences with the drink. I always try not to just gloss over that. You know, I had several months of relatively social drinking, and that there were other people around when that happened. There was lots of these sort of sneaking out in the middle of the night, and let's get some of this substance and get some of this drink and mix things together, and you know, find somebody who can get us. You know, we'll go to the packaged goods store for us, or steal things from parents' liquor cabinets, and you know, let's meet at the woods under the tree, and just these absolutely fantastic, fun, adventurous experiences. You know, because before that, my life was a series of, you know, just being a little kid. You know, I was addicted to the rush. You know, I was addicted to something. You know, I liked to throw rocks at things and vandalize stuff and throw eggs at cars and rocks at friends and slingshots and fireworks at friends and, you know, just anything to get a rise out of, you know, just what's going to happen. You know, let's light the wick and see what's going to happen. You know, that was my life. Like, get some adventure, you know, just sitting down, normal, me, what I'm supposed to do, like sitting in a classroom or in church or in anything. It was just like, I just wanted to jump out of my skin, you know, at the thought of something like that. So the drink was fun and it was an adventure. And for a long time, even when I was sober, I thought that the reason I was an alcoholic was because I drank too much. I liked drinking too much and drank too much and became alcoholic. And for a long time, I thought that the root of recovery was in one day at a time staying away from that drink. I view it differently today. You know, I think that there are actually a number of people I know that I work with or am related to, and you know, have a couple friends who on occasion like to drink and really like to drink, have a great time, you know, social thing, or, you know, just after work or a work event, and can drink a lot of alcohol and definitely can feel that euphoria and have a wonderful time with it. But when it's not time to drink, they can also focus on the task at hand and don't seem like they want to kill themselves and about four other people that are near them at all times. You know, they seem to basically just be able to function and enjoy other things as well, and you know, not drink at wildly inappropriate times and these sorts of things. So I think when it comes to the drink, you know, I think what it did for me is kind of set off that other major sort of bucket of symptoms that I think of as alcoholism, which is it just sets off this whole thing that is really hard. It's really hard to put it exactly into words, but this thing where I basically, you know, I basically can't control the amount that I drink, you know, over any real period of time. You know, I drink for irrational reasons. You know, the great majority of my drinking can be explained by a kid who was living a relatively pathetic life on the inside, an absolutely fine life on the outside, two loving parents, a loving sister, you know, everything that I ever needed provided for me, you know, certainly not any material wealth around me. You know, I had the terrible hardship of generic shoes growing up, you know, all these hard, terrible things. I used to feel like I was such a victim from that, and there's mental illness in my family and all these human things that people have, but fundamentally I had everything I could ever really need to be happy. But I didn't feel that on the inside because I had this spiritual malady thing. You know, I could sit, it could be Christmas Eve and there could be smell of, you know, of turkey and ham, and, you know, it could be a warm house, I mean, a roaring fireplace, presents under the tree, family gathering from all around, you know, smiling faces, just not a problem in the world, you know, a nice blanket of fresh snow on the outside, and I'll be sitting on there on the couch just feeling like I'm going to jump out of my own skin, like looking to create a fight or create something, because there's this peace and this comfort around me that for whatever reason I didn't feel it here much of the time. And when I found the drink, it gave me relief from that. You know, it wasn't just fun. It wasn't just, yeah, rah, 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 euphoria, let's run around and do something stupid with somebody and have a great time, and then, oh, there's a hangover. You know, there was absolutely all that. But after a little while, what I realized is that it did something for me. You know, it was there for me. It was there for me consistently. You know, that confused person that felt like such a victim and felt all that emptiness inside and all those different symptoms of that emptiness, looking for you to make me feel loved, or looking for something, you know, looking, you know, afraid of people and looking for something for defense and looking for all these worldly things. The drink was a consistent worldly thing. I drank it and it made me feel that way, like a switch, you know, every time. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, a good friend of mine was saying, he said, Anheuser, that's really good quality control over there at Anheuser-Busch, you know, that, which is true. I never cracked a can of Busch or Bud or whatever it is. Didn't have the ingredients in it that I needed, you know? And I drank that stuff, and just to be clear, when I say drank that stuff, I mean smoked that stuff, swallowed that stuff, whatever, you know, I used it all for the same reason. But when I drank that stuff, I felt comfortable, you know, and I could rely on it to make me feel a certain way. And I got really, really dependent on it. And I had this feeling, which is another thing that alcoholics, a lot of them I think can understand, but non-alcoholics, not so much. You know, I had this feeling about like I had a relationship with that substance. You know, and at times it was like borderline romantic. You know, I mean, I felt this love. I mean, I'm probably not the only person in here that could embrace a bottle, you know, and just feel the warmth in a cold bottle of whatever or a warm bottle of whatever at the end of, you know, a Tupperware thing of warm gin under a car seat or something like that. I mean, I could feel, you know, something in my heart. You know, we talk about, you know, having that feeling of comfort come over us before we even start drinking this stuff. Just having it, knowing it's coming, that Pavlov's dog, and I'm drooling, you know, when I pull up to the liquor store kind of thing, you know, just knowing that it's coming. I felt that powerful relationship and that powerful connection. The delusion of a relationship, because it's not really there, it's just a substance, you know. But that whole thing explains, big picture, most of the way I drink, in my opinion. But there's this other thing that happens, which is let's just say, you know, on any given weekend, I get myself a case of beer, you know, together, and I'm going to get comfortable on Friday night and Saturday night. The thing that I would do is I would drink the 12 for Friday, and then it'd be, you know, whatever time it is, 11:30, and I'm just a little thirsty, and then this wonderful thought comes into my mind, which is 11 beers is plenty for tomorrow night. That's fine. 11 beers, I will get fine. I can sleep after I have 11 beers. I've done worse. That's fine. I'll do 13 tonight, and then I drink the 13, and it's and I just like, you know, that whole thing is one more. Maybe I drank 18. I don't know. Maybe there's 6 in the morning. Oh, screw it. I'm, you know, messed up anyway. Might as well just have those 6 before I get out of bed in the morning. And then it's noon on Saturday, and what have I done? You know, I had the life by the, you know, I was there. I had it together. I'd managed, you know, because in my case, my drinking at the age that I did it, I did a lot of, you know, I often say I did a lot of really healthy college drinking when I was in middle school, you know, and this middle school and high school, you know, young drinking is not easy in my case, you know. I mean, not drinking's easy for anybody, regardless of what your age and your outside circumstances. But, you know, my particular circumstance, I wasn't putting in an honest 8 hours, you know, punching out somewhere and then going to a bar and having legal drinks for a reasonable price with some friends. I was begging and borrowing and stealing and, you know, selling and bartering and trading and, you know, conniving and lying. And, you know, it was a lot of work to get drunk, you know. But I would miss the mark, you know, for just no apparent reason. I would just blow past it regularly. I would mismanage, you know, and that is a low feeling, you know. For me, to believe as strongly as I did that the drink was the greatest thing in the world, that it was there for me, that it was wonderful, that sobriety was bad, and the drink was good, and to have that and then to mismanage it was a terrible, terrible feeling. For what it's worth, and. What happened for me, I must admit, the last few years, I've asked to speak a fair amount. It usually comes in clusters. I'll speak a couple times a week, and then I won't speak for a few weeks, and then I'll speak in clusters. And this is selfish, I know, but I am so sick of telling the pathetic, weak facts of my own drinking. You know, the when and the where and the how much and all this, I have no stories of, you know, drinking some tequila and then waking up south of any border. I mean, I didn't wake up south of the Maryland border. I mean, I had a boring set of circumstances in regards to, you know, exciting, fun stories. You know, after a while, I did the things that alcoholics of my type, I think, do, which is on a daily basis, I made choices based on how I could drink the way I want to drink. You know, and if I saw you as someone that could help me drink that way, then I loved you. You were fantastic. We were friends. I did everything I could to be kind and nice and cozy up to you. And if I thought you were someone who stood in between me and my drinking, then I hated you. I wanted to destroy you. I wanted to discredit you. I wanted to get away from you. And, you know, and if you didn't do either, then I barely knew you were there. You know, and you know, that was not a particularly healthy way to drink. And a way to live my life. You know, I was also, you know, got into, you know, a wide variety of drinking, and in some of those communities, it helps a lot to be friends with the people that you're engaging with, interacting with. I was the kind of guy that really just wanted the stuff, and when the drink got there, I was gone until I needed the drink again. So I wasn't very good at, you know, that sort of engaging in those sorts of transactions. So it was very lonely. And, you know, what happened, and what I think is important today is that, you know, I pushed people away, you know, people that loved me and that cared about me, you know, namely my, you know, my parents, my sister, you know, friends that I'd had since I was a little kid. You know, I made some deeply delusional and selfish decisions, you know, to not just allow the drink to stand between me and them, but to actively push them away so that I could drink the way that I wanted to drink. You know, I physically fought both of my parents, you know, verbally fought them, verbally attacked them in ways that are, you know, extremely disrespectful and not the kind of person that I was raised to be or want to be. you know, I found myself in a lot of the typical sorts of troubles, you know, a little bit of legal, lots of people coming down, trying to talk to me, lots of therapy, lots of doctors, some emergency rooms, the inpatient rehab, and then the aftercare and the plan and the meds and the go see this guy on Tuesday and Wednesday and the aftercare and the meeting slips and all that stuff, and then, oh, that doesn't work, and then back into the emergency room for the other overdose and then into another treatment center. You know, that's, I did all that sort of stuff. You know, it's a lonely existence for me to be in a spot where the only, you know, my basic experience was, it's funny, recently the image I've had in my mind of what my drinking was like was, it was as if sobriety was like a monster, you know? To just be sober, to be me, to be normal, to be straight, to be able to feel all my fingers and toes, to have clear thoughts, it was as if it was a monster in a dream, like chasing me down this long hallway. And I'm just running down the hallway, trying to do everything I can to get away from that monster, you know? And you know, jumping over logs and throwing trash cans at it and doing everything I can to just destroying my life, destroying my health, throwing away relationships in this attempt to just be numb, you know? And it's an absolute miracle to go from that way of living life, that perception, to a perception where I start to think, well, maybe, just maybe, the alcohol might be something to do with the problem, or maybe that is a problem, or maybe there's this other world of sobriety. Maybe there's a way where somebody like me can be happy and can be sober at the same time, you know? And it's a scary, confusing, painful, embarrassing time, and, you know, a time where anyone who was around me that could be a part of helping me to make that transition, I was pushing away because I just didn't have the ability to communicate with those people. You know, I think what happened to me when I came to 12-step meetings for the first time was something really magical, because before that I'd had, I don't know, maybe 50 times, maybe 100 times, situations where I was sitting down in some kind of room and there was usually like two or three or four people on one side and then there was me on another side. Maybe there's a table, or maybe it's just chairs, or maybe it's a living room. And these people, you know, maybe we're in a hospital, maybe I'm in a hospital bed, and these people are coming in, and I invite them. You know, there are these circumstances where people are telling me, look at your life. You know, look at the calculation. Look at what opportunity you have. Look at the gifts you've been given. Look at who loves you. And look at what you're doing. You're throwing this away. You're killing yourself. Look at what you're doing to your parents. Look at what you're doing to your future. Blah, 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 you know? And the first thing my mind does when I hear that is try to figure out ways to convince you that I didn't do it. It wasn't me. Somehow you're confused. If there's no chance of that not working, then it's the next level is it was the first time, or I was a victim, or I accidentally drank this stuff, and then something not my fault. I don't know what you're talking about. But even at times, and there were many times where there is none of that spin, it's just, you're just red-handed, you know, you're just caught, it's like, it's not the first time, it's not the second time, it's not the third time, and you're just sitting there, and it's like, I just got nothing, you know? And the thing was, part of what's so extremely lonely about this place is that the calculation for me was so completely different than the calculation for everyone on the outside of this. To the outside, they just see a person that has no real worldly problems. You know, a person living without war, without great poverty, without, you know, I have 10 toes and 10 fingers to feel. You know, I've got all these gifts that everyone else can see, and they just see the insane behavior and the destruction. They don't know what it's like to be on the inside of this and to have that life experience where sobriety is like a monster chasing me down a hallway in a dream. You know, and I had no ability to even put into my own mind, much less into words, to explain to somebody, like, yeah, I get it, I understand, I could be killing myself, I'm doing all these terrible things, but hello, I don't care, you know, all I care about is the way I feel today. Like, I don't care if what I'm putting into my body today shaves 5 years off the end of my life or gives me a 1 in 10 chance of waking up after this weekend. I don't care, because waking up sober is just, I'd rather not even do it, you know what I mean? So that's a lonely place, and to go from that place, you know, to that other place where my brain is like switched around and sees the drink as part of the problem and sees, you know, the possibility of a happy recovery, is a massive change. And one that, again, at times in my sobriety, if you'd asked me to come up here and speak, I would have given you these rational reasons and told you way more of the facts about how I had overdosed on this thing and I couldn't urinate and there's all this pain and all this embarrassment. And I went to this violent detox and it was Wednesday and like all these stupid facts that don't matter. The reality, as I see it today, is that some power acted in my life without my permission. It wasn't my idea. You know, none of those things were my idea. You know, it wasn't my idea to get sober, you know, or to go away to happy pills again. It was something, in my opinion, greater than human acting in my life to just create the right set of circumstances, the right set of pain and motivations and just everything just twisting around to allow me to get to that spot. You know, and I think it was just a gift from God, an unearned gift, that I was able to be sober and to be in this spot where I was a day sober, you know, a minute sober, 5 days sober, you know, 5 weeks sober, where that itch and that thing and that faith and that belief that the next drink is just going to give me the comfort that I need was removed. But what happened on the outside is, those things happened, I did go to Happy Hills again and came out. I was there for a short period of time, and my perception on the world was different. You know, for a very brief period of time, I got this gift where that little voice in my head that tells me all these stupid lies and, you know, basically like that whole scenario of sitting down, let me convince these people something else is going on, let me smoke in mirrors, and then somehow I'm off drinking the Mad Dog 2020 in the corner and no one notices. That kind of thing just shut up, you know, and I knew deep down that my ideas for how to live my life were not serving me well at all. And I was open to other people's ideas about how to live my life. And what happened from that day until, you know, I've been sober for a while, and what happened for years, really my whole experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that when I drag that sad person into a group, every group I've ever been to, and I've had different home groups, I've had different sponsors, I've lived in somewhat different geographic areas, and every time from the very first meeting I ever went to, literally, I mean, I walked out with an armful of literature and a book and phone numbers and all this stuff swimming around in my head. From that night until tonight, when you welcomed me warmly in that thing outside with the rain cover roof, what do you call that, a vestibule or whatever it is? You know, every single time that I have, what is it?
Breezeway,
thank you. Every single time I've come to a group, there have been people there that are willing to bend over backwards to make available to me the things that were made available to them to recover. You know, and that is, it's just this really special, different thing, because when a guy like me hears that, and I can sit down in a meeting or listen after a meeting, and instead of someone telling me, you know, look at what you need to do, look at what you're doing, look at the facts of your life, now this is messed up. Instead of that, it's somebody standing there and saying, hey, this is how I drink. This is why I drank. This is what it felt like when I drank. This is what it felt like when I didn't drink, you know, and then I went back to drinking. and then I'm like, and all of a sudden I can listen. You know, it's not just that I want to listen, it's that I can listen, because when other people are telling me this and this and this, I can't, even if I want to listen, even at those times where I know I'm on a path that isn't fun, I know I'm making mistakes, but then the person comes in and starts to tell me, my mind just won't do it. I won't listen to someone pointing a finger and telling me what to do. But people making their own experience, speaking in the first person about themselves and trying to make that available to me, just allows me to speak. And people have done absolutely amazing things for me. You know, my first sponsor, when I first got sober, I was living with my parents. I had no car, I had no job, I had no money, I had no friends, I had no ability to get any of those things. I had no job skills, essentially a high school dropout. You know, I was deeply depressed. I could, you know, today I can stand up in front of people and I can like stand in a straight way and like look at people in the eye. I couldn't do anything like that. I could shuffle in, I could, you know, walk like this on the floor, but I couldn't even make that much of a straight line. It's like if you were there, I'd be like one of these walking around you kind of thing. You know, I couldn't make jokes. You know, at times I was able to, you know, laugh and have fun, but when I was newly sober, I just had I was just nothing. You know, I was just dragging my butt around. And people reached out and just really made things available to me. You know, just this fellowship just opened its arms to me. You know, my first sponsor was this guy Mike, and you know, he had a thing. He had a Mercury Lynx. This is 1995, and he had what was, I don't even know, like a 1982 Mercury Lynx, and it was a little hatchback car with the hatchback like tied down with a couple of bungee cords, and he usually had a donut on one of his four wheels. The thing burned a quart of oil every day, and he lived in South Baltimore and I lived in Towson. It was about a 20-minute drive, and you know, in what I do these days, a 20-minute drive, no big deal, but for years it was a huge deal. And what he did was about 5 days a week, he would drive across town in that car, you know, pick me up, take me to a meeting, take me out to coffee, he'd usually pay, and then he'd drop me off at, you know, 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night, and then drive back to South Baltimore. You know, it's a guy that's the car he could afford, and he made that available to me for my first year of sobriety. He did that probably on average 5 nights a week, you know? And that's just one of many, many examples of the ways that people just, this principle of trying to reach out and make things available to me. The another thing that happened to me, and I'll try not to talk about this for too long, but for whatever reason, when I first got sober, I was terrified of the drink. Terrified of that thing, of that mismanagement, and all the ugly stuff that I did, the stealing from people, I left out a lot of the facts, but I did a lot of really wildly selfish, dishonest things to drink the way that I drank, and had some real impact on other people. I didn't know it, but it's one of the things that doing a fourth and a fifth step and an eighth and a ninth step taught me. It allowed me, you know, not taught me intellectually, but had my butt in front of those people talking about what I did and then saying, is there anything else? And then hearing, you know, and then having a change that came over me that allowed me to hear and allowed me to empathize with people, allowed me to sort of put myself in their position and realize, wait a second, you know, my behavior does really have an impact on people. I completely lost my train of thought. Where was I? That's funny. I completely lost that thought. Anyway, what happened was, oh yeah, that's what, yeah, the drink. What happened was, I always spend like 12 minutes with talking about this experience, and it should take 2 minutes. I thought that the drink was the root of what it meant to be an alcoholic. And for years, everything I did, my prayers were, dear God, please give me another day sober. I really, really want another day sober. Thank you. And then at the end of the night, thank you so much for another day sober. Please give me another day sober. And by the way, I'd like this, maybe Redhead. Another two fifty more an hour if possible. 150 minutes is fine, but something in a management position. Thank you. You know, I did these completely selfish prayers, and AA was at its root a place where I could stay sober one day at a time, under the desperate hope that if I strung together enough one day at a times, something miraculous would happen and I could be happy. When I really wasn't deep down happy, I was doing a lot of AA. I was making a lot of coffee. I was going to meetings and things like that. But the program that I was working was about how do I stay sober one day at a time. It was not about how do I get connected with a power greater than myself. It was not about how can I make my experience available to the still suffering alcoholic. It was me and mine. And by the way, where's mine? And let's talk about me. And I know we're supposed to go into a movie, but let's sit in the car for 3.5 hours and just talk about us and me and what I'm not getting and what you don't understand about me and me and me and me and me and me. And I would lie in bed at night for 45 minutes, hour and a half, 3 hours, most nights, not able to fall asleep, thinking about me, thinking about what I'm missing out, what I need to do, you know, and just desperately wanting to be connected to something. You know, it was like I was, you know, 9 years old again at summer camp and lying there unable to sleep, you know, listening to the other kids snore and just feeling like I'm going to jump out of my skin, you know. I had that experience happen again in sobriety for years. And what I did was I chased things. You know, that thing I talked about when I first started talking of, I show up to the table with a fear you know, like a fear of not enough money or a fear of being unlovable or fear of not being able to be loved by friends or whatever it is. And then I respond by just like a movie montage. You know, it's like I'm afraid of other men physically. So let's eat the, you know, 8 meals and the egg whites and the oatmeal and hit the gym twice a day and the muscle magazines and this and that in desperate hope that I'll be this huge guy that no one, you know, that I will feel comfortable, you know. And you know, I had this fear of being stupid. So let's go to community college and then let's go to a 4-year college and let's go to a law school. And I have a fear of being poor. So let's absolutely break my back getting the best grades I possibly can in law school and go work for a big law firm and see how, you know, and do that. And like just desperately putting, you know, the hope into these outside circumstances in belief that I will feel different when I get those worldly things. And sometimes it would happen. Sometimes I get the thing that I wanted and I would often feel great for 15 seconds to 2 days, depending on what it is. Like a good round of grades in graduate school, that's good for about a week and a half until I get like the books for the next semester and realize I'm an idiot and I can't do this and I'm a fraud and I'm going to be a failure and they're all going to figure out that I'm stupid, you know. And you know, the point was that I was trying. It wasn't that there's anything wrong with a girlfriend or sports or a career or money or education or travel or anything. You know, the world is full of worthwhile, fantastic pursuits. It's just that none of those worthwhile pursuits are going to treat an empty spiritual condition that I have in my heart. You know, and that was something that I spent 9 years, you know, getting to a place of pain where I was able to receive a message of that. And that's what happened some years ago. A guy shared this different approach to me. It was, you know, it's nothing magical, and it seemed cult-like when I first heard about it because it was so different than what was going on in my head. But basically, he had discovered a thing called the Big Book, and he'd opened it and looked inside, and he'd seen some stuff about a spiritual malady, and he found some directions for recovery. He read these fantastic things on 60 to 63 and all this sort of stuff. And I say it as if he did it, but the reality was somebody pointed it out to him the way that somebody had to point it out to me, which is like, hey, you know, broken, sad guy, let's listen. And why don't you listen and I'll share some principles with you. And by the way, let me show you a couple of magical places in the book where there's directions. And oh my God, there's directions in the book. I did not know. And it's, wow, it's wildly simple. Okay, I can do that, and okay, I can call you back, and then do this, and then do that, and do this, and do that. And what I got to see was a different view on the first step. One where instead of just, you know, I'm powerless over how much drink I consume, and as a result of that, my life becomes a big pile of mess. It's, I'm powerless like this, like with a capital P. You know, like there's a disconnected state that I'm dragging around and dragged around into my drinking and into my sobriety for years. And the way I put that into words, and I know this is so completely cheesy and corny, but it's what I believe, it's that powerless state is where I cannot see and believe in my heart that I'm nothing more and nothing less than a little piece of God. You know, there are a lot of metaphors, wonderful metaphors that we use around here, like I'm another bozo on the bus, I'm another squirrel trying to get a nut, I'm another one of God's kids. You know, you can go real religious. You can go, you know, steel worker style in these metaphors. There's a lot of different ways to say it. But it's basically just, I was born as me. Can't control that. At time, trust me, I tried. I tried really hard to be a different person many times in my life. Can't do it. But that there's basically nothing wrong with that. You know, that I can wake up in the morning and be me and be comfortable in my own skin. And the only way that I could do that and actually feel that regularly, not just for 5 minutes when I'm running through the finish line of some goal thing, you know, that I've created, you know, or when she says yes or whatever, it's that I could just wake up day after day, week after week, month after month, and be okay with the person that I am, you know, and actually even, you know, and don't I need not go overboard with this, but there's even this thing in life now where I'm able to even get to know who I am a little bit more. You know, like for so long I was afraid of my own ideas because they weren't your ideas. They weren't good enough. They weren't smart enough. You know, I was so consumed with trying to become someone better than who I am that I forgot to even care who I am and forgot to care about my opinions and what I like out of life and what I value in life. And what this fascinating thing is that in recovery, it's possible for me to not only not be a slave to alcohol and all the things that I have to do to, you know, to measure out, you know, to get that 12 beers a day or whatever it is in me. That's a slave that I was, you know, but I can also be sober and be a slave to, you know, having a companion, or a slave to, you know, a career, or a slave to sports. You know, I can be a slave to a lot of things. And in doing that, I can also lose myself and lose any sense of who I am and not care about who I am, you know? And I say tread into this, for me, I have to tread into this world cautiously, because I can get caught up in this, well, who am I? Let's not go to the meeting. Let's not try to help anybody. Let's sit home and write about who I am and what I want and where I need to go, and let's think about work. And you know what? They're really not treating me well. I should be making more money. I should be his boss, you know? Because I can fall into that really, really quickly. But nonetheless, it's this wonderful thing where basically what happened, and I kind of got ahead of it slightly. I don't know that it matters, but what happened was I went through these steps again, that big book way, and had a spiritual awakening. You know, I had this experience that I had never had before, where it was this big. There are three experiences I've had in my life that were all equally life changing. When I found the drink, that was a huge experience. There was life before that, and there was life after. And on a daily basis, the way I looked at the world was different. And then there was when I got sober, when the drink became, you know, rather than being the only friend in the world, it became my biggest enemy. That was a world changer. With, you know, and I sometimes glaze over this, but with lots of wonderful, wonderful results. You know, the cash register honesty was there, and I found myself mugging friends far less often in recovery. You know, the physical stuff, which with years sober, it's easy to disregard that and just forget it, because I do forget it. But, you know, to be physically addicted to substances, you know, to have a brain that's so foggy that I just can't remember things, and, you know, the confusion, and, you know, not being able to remember anybody's phone number, and all these sorts of things that come along with the drink. And then just wildly, just crazy, confused, you know, experiences that I had over the drink itself. But anyway, number two, getting away from that, having that major change. And then the third biggest change that's ever happened in my life was when I had that spiritual awakening. Going from a daily, I mean, hour by hour, almost minute by minute experience of life, where I thought that the solution to what ails me is that I need a good plan. I need a better plan. I need an awesome plan. I need a career plan. I need a relationship plan. I need a recovery plan. I need to manage. I need to figure. I need to meet the right people. I need to manipulate. I need to go from here to here to here. I need a 3-year plan. I need a 1-year plan. I need a 3-month plan. I need a morning plan. I need a plan to get me to the plan. And it was all this, just all of this deep faith that this is going to produce the thing that's somehow going to yield happiness in my heart. You know, and it wasn't for lack of trying that didn't really yield. It yielded some great things. You know, on the outside, you know, when I had that third spiritual experience, when I was deeply unhappy with myself, on the outside there were plenty of reasons to be happy. No shortage of them. I was in a third year of law school, and I had friends, and I had a relationship with a family, and I had probably had no girlfriend, but I had the ability to have girlfriends. I'd proven that to myself. You know, there were all these things on the outside where I could basically show up and function. I could move my body around on a daily basis like a person that lives a normal life does. You know, I'd learned these tricks of, you want to have a friend? Be a friend. It's like, whoa! You know, like I was still wildly selfish in coming at that. Like, the only thing, like, well, I want this guy to be there for me next weekend. So, oh, you're moving, huh? Yeah. Guess who's going to come over? This guy. I'm going to come over and help you, and I make a big production about it and come over, and then meanwhile next weekend I just want you to come help me out. But anyway, then what happened was I had this thing where we went through the steps. You know, I saw that spiritual nature, that spiritual problem that I've spoken about more than I need to, and then an answer for that was based on a relationship with a higher power. You know, it was based on a relationship with this God that I couldn't understand, couldn't define, but needed to throw my will and throw my feet and my actions into this relationship, which was a huge jumping off point. And one that I think for a long time, you know, I joke about the pain and the way that I lived in sobriety and that, you know, things hidden in the big book. the long story of that, or the medium length story, we don't have time for the long story, is that I knew that there was a spiritual aspect to this program. I didn't realize it was all spiritual, but I knew that there was a spiritual aspect, and I wanted that. I wanted to be a good student. I wanted to be a good AA-er. But I fell into this trap where I thought that to have a relationship with a God of my understanding meant that I had to understand God. I'm at the table, I got my pen, I got my paper, I'm willing, it's Saturday morning, let's do it, I'm here to have a relationship with God, awesome, okay. So, and the thing that I would do to start that off is, all right, well, what's God? What is God? How does God work? Why is God? When is God? Where is God? What is God not? What is God on a Wednesday night? What is God on a Sunday afternoon? You know, like, and I would have to, you know, I went right up into my head to try to intellectually understand God and define God. And I think that was a task that had there was no winning that. You know, I could never and have never in my experience come up with a rational intellectual argument of like A, B, C, D, therefore God, you know. I heard people trying. You know, I heard the parking space God and the traffic God, and I can't believe 95 from Northern Virginia to Baltimore, 45 minutes on a Tuesday at 6 o'clock. Are you kidding me? There's got to be a God. You know, my aunt was sick and we all thought she was dying, and it turns out it's just gas and she's fine. That God loves me, that kind of God. But then, you know, where is that God when there is no parking space and, you know, all these things happen, and it never held water for me, and I just got caught up in all this thinking and none of this faith and none of this recovery, none of this spiritual awakening. So what I had to do was get comfortable with the idea that I might not know it all, you know, and not only that, but that I might just be created in a way that I can't know it all. You know, there's this great story. What do I have, like 7 more minutes? I think I have about 7 more minutes. There's a great story, and certainly good use of the few minutes I have left, that I heard someone say or tell in an AA meeting a number of years ago, and then I remembered it, and I've been saying it all the time. It's an analogy to fish. So, you know, fish swim around all their lives, you know, and they have, you know, like let's say salmon, for instance, they have light bellies and dark backs. And they swim around, and you know, the big fish or whatever that's below them looks up and it sees the light belly of the fish against the light of the sky. The fish is hidden and is protected. Same thing with the dark in the back. You know, there's birds or whatever, big fish in the top. They look down, they see the dark back of the fish against the dark depth of the ocean. Fish is hidden, fish is protected. This is happening basically the whole life of the fish. I don't think salmon know that this is happening. Like, I don't know that they can even see, like, they have the two eyes, one on either side. I don't even think they can figure it out, like, see it, or like, and like, know that there's stuff below them, or know that there's birds, or, like, have any idea this is happening. And it's not just that, like, whatever fish that we might find and study is dumb. It's just that all salmon were created, that their, like, zone or scope of knowable things is only this big. And that really important fact that is keeping their butts alive every day of their life is outside of that zone. They just can't know it. But, you know, we're people, and, you know, some of us, like, you know, think we're really, really smart, and, you know, like, I can go to college, and I can, you know, remember your name for 5 minutes, maybe, sometimes. Like, you know, I mean, sometimes I get really arrogant and think, well, I know everything. I should be able to know everything. I mean, everything in this world, if I can't know it, then it's not real, you know? But maybe that's BS. You know, maybe there's this zone of things that are happening in my life all the time that I can't know. You know, maybe I'm just not able to understand God. It's a very long-winded way of saying that. You know what I mean? You know, maybe any human definition that I put on God is limiting God, you know? And so what I had to do, or what I did do, was basically just shut up that intellectual question-asking, trying to explain thing, and just have something, you know, take a leap. You know, take a leap of faith and have trust that there is something out there, and get involved in this relationship, and, you know, move along with these steps, and, you know, do a fourth and a fifth step, and get a look at, you know, get a look at my part in these situations, and, you know, do an eighth and a ninth step and clean up my part in these situations, and experience that freedom, you know, of identifying a spiritual problem, identifying a spiritual relationship based on serving God. You know, that was a massive mind-blowing thing to me when I heard that. That this relationship with God is not designed to be selfish. It's not, hey, God, please help me stay sober one day at a time. Help me get a good job. Help me get the things that I want. And if you do, I will say thank you very much and skip along and enjoy my life. It's not that. It's on page 63 of our big book, this prayer that very clearly lays out this relationship where it's, God, please take from me this mess, this alcoholic suffering, all these blocks, so that I can go out into the world and be an example of the things that you can do for other people, so that you can use me to help other people. It's a give and take, you know? And in my experience, when I got to that stage of the steps, it was very clear that I was there almost entirely for myself, you know? You know, it was my own pain that had motivated me into the conversation where someone was pointing these things out to me and I was understanding them for the first time. And what he said to me very humbly is like, yeah, I get it. That's the fact. You know, that's the case for somebody who by definition is self-centered to the core and suffering from all this, you know, this self-centered fear. But what we have to do is simply have that thing, that bit of willingness, that bit of honest desire to be a part of a selfless relationship rather than a selfish relationship. And no matter how small that is, God can work with that, you know? And for me, that was small, and God worked with it. And I went through these steps, and I found my part, and I cleaned up my part, and I got this enormous flash of freedom after I did the ninth step, or after I got into doing the ninth step, that just absolutely changed my perspective of life, period. You know, no longer did I think that I was a victim of things that had happened in my family before I was even born. You know, I was able to see the love that was showered upon me by friends and parents. I was able to appreciate the friends that were around me. I was able to appreciate life. I mean, it was as if I was, you know, the metaphor of being reborn. I felt that. I mean, it was just really powerful. I know this is cheesy. I know it's cheesy. And when I first heard people talk about this stuff, this is like Children of the Corn sort of scary, freaky stuff. That was my first view of the people that went to the home group that I used to belong to called Harbor City. And it was some scary stuff, but that is what I experienced. And what happened was, you know, I wish I was 55 minutes seems like so long until you're 50 minutes into it. And then it's like, I want to hit a button and get 40 more minutes and tell you guys all this other stuff. But what happened really simply is I got that change of experience. I got that freedom. I got that comfort. And then little by little, you know, I had this huge flash where I wanted to read the big book. I wanted to read AA history. I wanted to,